Good afternoon, Your Honour. Martin Brown, Attorney Registration Number 12181, appearing on behalf of the appellant. Your Honour, this case arises out of a decision of Douglas County in which the court determined that the overtime that the father was earning should be taken into account in fixing child support, even though that income was, that overtime, I should say, was voluntary. As a matter of, the basic law is, Your Honours, that gross income includes income from any source and includes but is not limited to overtime pay only if the overtime is required by the employer as a condition of employment. And in this case, the overtime was purely voluntary. And in the trade, we use the word voluntary and involuntary to determine the difference between the required by an employer as a condition of employment, which is involuntary, and voluntary, where you are saying, I want to work some overtime, if I can do it, I will do it. The problem arises this way. Under 14.115, subsection 5A1Z, overtime pay is only considered in gross income if the overtime is required by the employer as a condition of employment. And the mother conceded, and the court found, that the overtime that was carried out by the dad was not required by the employer as a condition of employment. So it should have been excluded from the child support that was ordered. But in actual fact, the court ordered that his base pay plus his overtime would be the basis of the child support worksheet.
Mr. Brown, how do you propose that we reconcile In Re the Marriage of Dunkel with In Re the Marriage of Rice, where
I can go back perhaps a little bit to the history of these two sections. They were both passed in the House Bill 92-1230, and in that time they referred in about what is now 8E, which is section 14.10.1153A, and what is now in the IZ is in was in then subsection 7A1C, which said gross income includes overtime pay only if the overtime is required by the employer as a condition of employment. After that, you then have to go, Your Honour, to the Senate Bill 96-2, at which time the legislature referred to paragraph C, gross income includes overtime pay only if the overtime is required by the employer as a condition of employment. And they went on to say that gross income does not include income from additional jobs that result in the employment of the obligor more than 40 hours a week.
And you're not relying on that, the section about additional jobs, right? Because this is the same job. He's just working additional hours at the same job?
He's just working additional hours at the same job. But if you then go on, and this is where it comes from, you really need a calculus degree, and I think Your Honour may have had one. If you look at statute as it now is, you have 14.10.115, etc., etc., Z, which is overtime pay only if the overtime is required by the employer as a condition of employment, and it's that exception that creates the difficulty, because they go on in Roman numeral 2 to say gross income does not include, in paragraph C, income from additional jobs, etc. So therefore, what the legislature has done is take out the overtime pay that is not required and is distinct from what is required by the employer, which would be under C, the way it works. It's pretty complicated, and I can understand where the trial judge misunderstood section 8, subsection E, as it now stands, because you don't take into account that where the overtime used to be all in one lump, as you could say, of a subparagraph, the overtime that's not required by the employer is now in a separate subsection and not part of the earlier subsections. I'm sorry if it's complicated, but that's what it is.
But why isn't the trial court allowed to deviate, again, pursuant to the subsection 8E, based on the party's disparity in income?
Because the legislature's intent was quite unambiguous. The legislature's intent was that overtime pay is taken into account only if required by the employer as a condition of employment. But that specific provision, which is unambiguous, can't be overridden by a rather vague provision in paragraph 18, which incorporates a different section of subsection 5.
So then, are there other circumstances other than overtime or additional jobs above and beyond 40 hours where the court can try to equalize the part, not equalize, but try to take into account, for example, the children's needs? I don't believe that this child, there was testimony in this case about this child requiring, you know, special medical care or special training, if she was a musician, for example, but could the court then allocate a greater child support responsibility to the dad if that was the case?
In that case, Joanne, what's normally happened in my experience is that you look at something like, if it's a private school, in the Marriage of Pan Act, P-A-Y-A-N, the court will distinctly say this is what it is. If it's if it was insurance on a motor vehicle, which I think is Marriage of Lachlan, Your Honor, that didn't get included. If it's costs of additional parenting time, I'm going to think. There's a case of Marriage by Kaler, I-K-E-L-E-R, 148 Pacific 3rd, 347. It was reversed on appeal to the Supreme Court, but not on this particular issue, as I recall, where the woman had to look after triplets who were very young. And in that case, the court said, yep, that's fine, we'll give you additional funds to enable that to be done. Because of the looking after triplets when they're very young is very, very expensive.
Right.
Mr. Brown, pardon me. Domestic courts at heart are courts of equity, and the deviation guidelines have some examples of when child support, when a court may deviate. So in this particular case, if we agree with you that it's not gross income, the voluntary overtime, what would preclude the child court from just including the differences overall in fashioning an equitable child support award?
Well, I think you've got to look first. If mom has all of these activities that she wanted the child engaged in, what she should have done is have them expensed out. I want to do X, it'll cost Y. I want to do Z, it'll cost A, which she didn't do. Okay? And as far as being the court of equity, Your Honor, I respectfully suggest that the statute overrules the equitable desire that Your Honor may have, because the statute is very clear. This overtime does not get included in the income. And otherwise, you're falling into the trap with respect that equity is about as long as the Lord Chancellor's foot. It doesn't work that way, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
So your position is if mother had put on specific evidence below of costs of maybe specific activities or extracurricular activities, that would have afforded the trial court some discretion to consider the voluntary overtime or not?
I think no, it wouldn't. What it wouldn't have afforded the court discretion to consider the voluntary overtime. What it would have been entitled to the court to do is deviate from the guidelines. Because the guidelines are presumptive, but they can be changed. So if it's making a lot more money, then the court says, the court said, which it didn't do. Oh, in this case, he has all this extra money, assuming that he felt within the statute. I think he ought to pay more because these, I will deviate from the guidelines because. But the court didn't even deviate from the guidelines. It just, what it did was simply say, okay, he's earning extra because of his overtime. That's the reason to deviate. But that's not the way the statute works, Your Honor.
Thanks.
I'm not sure where I was. Part of the problem, Your Honor, is and I deal with, I reserve my issue for the waiver later. Quoting overnights, mother doesn't dispute the father exercises more than 92 overnights in even years, and we said that in our brief because she only dealt with the 2013 years. What happened is that the overnights, and this is a matter of mathematics, the court didn't do the mathematics. It just simply said it's a worksheet A. After it had fixed the parenting time schedule, what it should have done at that point was say, okay, I calculate the number of overnights to be X, therefore it's a worksheet A or a worksheet B. But he didn't do that. Your Honor, I'd reserve the other issues for later. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Brown.
Good afternoon. I'm Peggy Stevens, registration number 11513, here on behalf of the appellee, Lisa Timor. Mr. Brown has raised two issues on appeal. The first of those is, did the trial court err by including father's voluntary overtime in its computation of child support? And as the panel has noted in its questions, the statute 8E, permits by express language the court to deviate from the presumptive child support guidelines as a result of, quote, consistent overtime not considered in gross income under subparagraph C and so forth, or a second job that results in more than 40 hours worth of employment. The deviation portion of the statute under which Judge Speer made his findings and conclusions specifically permits the court to consider voluntary overtime income in its deviation. This was not a situation, as Mr. Brown has argued, in which the court didn't deviate from the guidelines. In fact, at paragraph 21 of the court's findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, the court specifically says the court is permitted to deviate from the presumptive child support guidelines pursuant to 1410.115.8b and proceeded to do just that, deviate from the child support guidelines.
Counsel, how do you address Mr. Brown's argument that in utilizing father's overtime as the basis for the deviation, the trial court effectively nullifies what the legislature said in subsection 5 of 115?
I don't see the statute as being internally inconsistent in the way that Mr. Brown does.
Can you explain why it's not?
Sure. On one hand, the court says parents can only be required to work full time. No parent should be required to work more than full time. And if you have them to take on the extra hour, that extra hour isn't going to count against you. Okay, so there we are. Now, second portion of the statute says if you do work consistent overtime, and that results in an increase in your income by, in this case, 2-3 times father's base income, then the child should not be deprived of your hard work, and the child should be supported at that higher level. It's not inconsistent. This is consistent voluntary overtime income chosen by a father versus that occasional overtime income that moms and dads sometimes work, which shouldn't count against them in their computation of child support.
But there does seem to be some disconnect in subsection 5, which says, unless it's required by the employer, it's not calculated in your gross income. And that's what I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around. On the one hand, the legislature has said, unless it's required, unless the employer requires it, and there was testimony, and the trial court accepted the testimony
Darn it.
We have to defer to that. I mean, we can't pretend like the court didn't accept.
Right.
The employer, you know, the supervisor testified, father testified that it was not a condition of his employment.
That's correct.
And so that's what I'm having trouble with, is how do we take that finding and then...
So the emphasis of the child support statute, and in fact the family law, or the Dissolution of Marriage Act itself, is to focus on the needs of the children. And what I think the legislature intended was that when a parent chooses to have a standard of living much higher than he would have with his base income, then the child should not be deprived of that elevated standard of living simply because we're not including it in your 40 hours per week. So focusing on the needs of the child and the reality of the father's ability to pay, the statute permits the courts to deviate from the child support guidelines. And Judge Spear walked through that extraordinarily carefully as he sort of balanced the child's needs against dad's ability to pay, mom's sort of foundational ability to care for the child. And I think Judge Spear just did an excellent job of maneuvering through the statute and finding a good balancing point and saying, yep, dad should pay that elevated child support amount because Delaney needs to be supported at this higher income level, this higher standard of living.
I don't recall that the parties talked about what kind of standard of living the child enjoyed before the parties separated. Was that testimony somewhere in the record and I missed it?
I do not believe you missed any testimony in the record. I believe both mother and father testified as to their standards of living at the time of the permanent orders hearing. Father was occupying a lovely home. Mother was occupying an apartment. Dad was able to afford whatever he wanted to afford for Delaney. Mom was struggling just to make the daycare payments. Mom was worried about Delaney living in 4T clothing rather than 6T, which is what she should have been wearing. She was worried about not being able to take her to the zoo and the butterfly pavilion and those kinds of things. But I don't believe either party testified as to the standard of living before the split.
And apparently there weren't any itemizations of anticipated increased cost for example, changing the clothing so that it was age appropriate, and so on. So that what we're left with, it seems to me, is a record that would indicate that all the court did here was calculate income. And in doing so, I'm hard pressed to ignore the plain language of the determination of income section, subsection 5, that says shall.
I believe you are, I know you are correct that there was no line itemization of the increased costs that mother anticipated having for Delaney should she receive a higher child support amount. What we know is that mother's child support was being used primarily for her daycare expense and for groceries, in mother's words. I can't get away from Section 8E. While overtime income is not included in the definition of income, I can't get away from the discretionary language of Section 8E, which allows the courts may deviate from the guidelines where its application would be inequitable, unjust, or inappropriate. And as a threshold finding, Judge Spear found that the application of the guidelines under the circumstances of these parties would be inequitable, unjust, and inappropriate.
But the provision that you rely upon is couched in terms of a rebuttable presumption.
Correct.
Which indicates to me But the person advancing that argument under this section needs to rebut the presumption. And the record here doesn't indicate there is any such rebuttal. On the contrary, it indicates that the judge felt, as a matter of fairness, that he should just ignore the provision on gross income because of the disparity created by voluntary overtime.
I don't think using the word the judge chose to ignore is an accurate reading of the judge's analysis in light of the AE section, which says that the court can consider consistent overtime not considered in gross income under subparagraph C and so forth.
Well, perhaps it was an inartful description, but I use the word ignore because I don't see the court's analysis paying homage to Section 5.
Well, actually, Judge Speer made it very clear, and I can absolutely tell you where he made it clear that in paragraph 19 of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the court says, Judge Speer says, the court finds the petitioner's overtime is voluntary and not a requirement of his current position. His overtime income shall not be included in the computation of child support. This conclusion is supported by 1410.115Z. It's very clear Judge Speer was maneuvering through the statute in the way that the statute contemplates. He understood that overtime income was not to be included. Fast forward to Section 8E allows him to deviate, and he makes those findings of fact needed to support the deviation under 8E. Mr. Brown's second argument was that the trial court erred in computing the number of overnights father exercises. Judge Speer himself computed the number of overnights. He then issued a worksheet A. If the number of overnights is computed as I see it and as Judge Speer sees it, there are only 90 overnights in 2013, justifying the use of the worksheet A. If the number of overnights is computed as Mr. Brown suggests, the matter should be remanded to Judge Speer to see if that's how he intends. But if that is indeed what he intended, then it would have been incumbent on Mr. Moore to demonstrate that not only does he spend 92 overnights with Delaney, but he also contributes to Delaney's expenses in excess of his payment of child support, and he did not do that. He didn't put on any evidence of having contributed to expenses in excess of the child support as he is required to do under 1410.115(3)H.
Ms. Stevens, I appreciate your argument on the worksheets, but I want to return to our first issue for just a moment. Looking at Judge Speer's order, and let's just say hypothetically that the panel agrees that AE applies, isn't there still an error, though, because in 21A, Judge Speer still appears to have included voluntary overtime as gross disparity income?
But under AE, it specifically says overtime income that results in a gross disparity of income. It's in the language of the statute. The way he has worded 21A, it is virtually the language of the statute in the way he sets that out.
Well, the statute actually sets off gross disparity income as separate from consistent overtime, not considered in gross income. And it appears that he conflated the two. So even if we were to agree with you, it doesn't require a remand anyway.
The answer to that question may be yes, but can I respond to the first
portion
of your question? Okay, so the statute lists the reasons for deviation, and it says, these are some reasons, these are not exclusive, you know the facts, you know the parties, you know the kidlet. please make a good decision based on deviation considering these factors. And one of the factors is gross disparity of income. One of the factors is consistent overtime not considered in gross income. It's not a matter of confusing the factors, it's a matter of combining the factors. And I think Judge Speer appropriately combined the factors rather than confuse the factors. I don't think he needed to line item a factor and then address it and then line item another factor and address it. I think these are factors that are possibilities but not exclusivities. The final thought that I will leave you with is that Judge Speer did an incredible job of issuing his findings of fact and conclusions of law. He worked his way through the statute, a difficult, extensive statute, made findings of fact consistent with the statute, and I'm asking that the decisions of Judge Speer be affirmed by this panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Diaz.
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, the problem arises again because it's the difference between the subsection Z and the other subsection C. And subsection AE refers back to Roman numeral 2C, which is additional income from additional jobs. And that used to be included in the with the overtime paid when one was had a look at the history of the how this statute has developed over the years. And it has developed changes, multiple changes, and this is why I referred to the Senate bills and the House bills previously. And I think with respect that's what we looked at first. Now, as far as the deviations are concerned, Your Honor, there have to be specific findings. If there are not specific findings, it doesn't meet the standard, even under IT, because it can be for very many different reasons, not, however, voluntary overtime. It can be for unusual hospitalization expenses, it can be particular school expenses, and we've had discussed that already. The problem with the overnights is this. The judge simply said, these are the number, this is how the parenting plan is going to work. But he didn't say, because of this parenting plan, there are X number of overnights or Y number of overnights. But he found that the parent, he found, as a matter of fact, what the parenting time plan was, in his mind, but he didn't go with that extra step doing the mathematics and say, this creates a number of overnights, which is either a worksheet A or a worksheet B. And that's what we've tried to do in our reply. As far as the contribution towards expenses is concerned, Your Honor, the situation is this. We don't have to prove every dollar that this father pays for his boy, for his child, I should say. These overnights are, there's a presumption, Your Honor, that he will provide for the child while he has the child. And as a result of that, that presumption that's in the Redford case that's cited in the brief is that he's presumed that he's going to spend money on the kid when he's got it. And he doesn't have to come up with every item that he may have spent during the time. Really, it's a question then of court simply accepting that as a father, he contributes to the child, he has activities for the child, and those are set forth in the record. And because he has the child and has time with the child, he necessarily has to have expenses in respect of the child. You can't ignore it. Even if 50 overnights, he would still have expenses for the child, but the way the statute is drafted and written, those expenses don't get taken into account unless and until he gets over the 93 threshold. And our argument is, Your Honor, that he has met that 93 threshold. It's a rather interesting situation because if you want to deviate from the guidelines, you have to show the amount of the deviation and why you're deviating. But if you're just saying, I want to do, if I have over 93 overnights, all I have to do is show that I have some expenses and that I'm looking after the child during that time, I don't have to show each of those necessary expenses for the time that the child is with me. It's a slightly different standard, but that's the way the statute is written, and nobody ever said the child support statute was clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Thank you again, Ms. Stevens. The matter is being submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.